The human psyche is sometimes divided into three different aspects, three different faculties. There's the cognitive faculty, what we know, how we know. There's the affective faculty, what we feel, what we emote. And there's the volitional faculty of what we do, how we act. And when you look at awakening, you can look at awakening from the point of these three different faculties. So if you look at its cognitive aspect, you're looking at wisdom, at clarity. You're looking at the affective aspect, you look at compassion, of love, peace. And we look at its volitional aspect, we're looking at freedom, liberation, and in particular liberated energy. So that's what I'm interested in today, is how do we liberate our energy? And you may know that the Tantra, Tantric Buddhism, is very much concerned with liberating energies, because awakening requires so much energy, it requires the integration of all our different energies to have them at our fingertips. We really have to know how to do that. We have to know how to work with our energies. So I'm going to look at three major chunks to my talk. First of all, I'm going to have a little bit of a rant. I'm going to rant especially about masculine energy, looking at energy in a more psychological sense. Then I'll look at energy in a more Buddhist sense, in terms of virya. And then I'll look at energy in a symbolic way, looking at the figure of Vajrapani. I think we have to acknowledge that as men, we have a bit of a problem. The masculine is problematic in our current climate, in our current society. Masculine energy, I would say, is distrusted to quite a large extent. And to try and put a bit of flesh on the bone, I just want to look a little bit archetypally at this. You may have come across the Jungian division of the masculine archetype in terms of the king archetype, the warrior archetype, the magician archetype, and the lover archetype. So the warrior is, if you like, the archetype of energy, of masculine energy. The magician is the archetype of masculine cognition, and the lover is the archetype of masculine emotion. And the king is the integrative archetype, where all those three reach their fullness. If you're interested in this, I'd recommend this book, King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, by Moore and Gillette. So these are the three mature archetypes of the masculine psyche. And each has its shadow side. And in particular, the shadow side of the warrior is very unappealing. It's the aspect of cruelty, of violence, destructiveness, callous disregard. And so it's quite understandable that it is mistrusted. We only have to think of drunken youths fighting in the streets. We only have to think of stupid wars being fought, psychopaths with guns, all this kind of stuff. This is the shadow of the warrior archetype that is coming out. So I think usually when people think of masculine energy, it's very often the shadow masculine warrior energy which is thought of. And I think we need to acknowledge that the feminine qualities are more in the ascendant in our climate. Now, plenty of room for disagreement with me there. Plenty of time to discuss it afterwards, I hope. But men are expected to be emotionally sensitive, kind to small children, do the housework and all that kind of thing. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not having a go at that as being a problem. The problem is more that it's very difficult to express masculine energy. I'll come on to this, but especially developing a more balanced masculine energy. And I think these attitudes feed through into Dharma practice, into contemporary Dharma practice, where there's an increasing emphasis on receptivity, on non-judgmental, bare mindfulness, kindness. And again, this is all really good stuff. I'm not having a go at that. But I think the more, how I think of as masculine qualities of clarity, making strong effort, being determined, being committed to practice, cultivating concentration. These are, I don't think they're talked about as strongly or with such confidence or in such appealing terms. So I think there's something about developing a healthy masculine energy. And especially a healthy masculine warrior archetype, if you like, which is a bit problematic at the moment. There's very few healthy examples around us. There's very few healthy contexts to develop it within. So the traditional ways that men become men, you know, going to war, becoming very ambitious within, sort of ambitious, ruthless within their particular trade, whatever it is, they're all a little bit skewed and they're not very prevalent either. So men tend to remain immature, in particular the media perception of men, I put to you, is as useless dolts. I won't go into that, but I've got plenty of examples for you if you're interested. So how do we develop this healthy masculine warrior archetype? I think we can't be too afraid of that kind of energy. If we're afraid of that kind of energy, especially in its more coarse, non-destructive forms, then it's going to be difficult to integrate it. It's a bit untidy. Those of you who have seen the film Fight Club, I think this is a very interesting film. It's a fable. People take it literally, but it's a fable about an impotent man, impotent, immature man, who comes into contact with untidy, unruly masculine energy in the form of Brad Pitt. Going through this process of integration and mayhem to come out to the end result of a healthy, integrated man. I was also hearing about Surata, Surati, you may know Surata Padmalokha, on a recent GFR retreat. There's this male mitra who finds Padmalokha a bit kind of a feat and doesn't quite know how to sort of engage with it all. And so Surata pumped weights with him at lunchtime. And he found this fantastic, a really good way to engage and to feel part of the retreat, pumping weights. So there's something about not feeling too embarrassed and ashamed about this. It's all part of our masculinity. And, of course, within Buddhism, it can be easy to take Buddhism as critical of masculine energy. You know, emphasis on kindness. Not to say that men can't be kind, but the emphasis on kindness might mean that we feel a bit reserved about communicating more forthrightly, more directly, mortified if we hurt anyone's feelings. The Buddha in the Pali Canon isn't all nice. I don't know how much you've read about the Buddha in the Pali Canon. Sometimes he comes out and says, "You useless monk, you stupid monk." And once I even heard him or read him saying, "You useless bag of filth." So that isn't very politically correct, is it? And recall Bhante's aphorism, "Better honest collision than dishonest collusion." And the famous aphorism, "A nice Buddhist is a dead Buddhist." So let's not buy too much into Buddhism as being about being nicey nice. So a healthy warrior energy from this book, just to give a sense of the qualities of a healthy warrior archetype. Qualities of self-control, clarity of mind, mastery of technique, think of expert swordsmen, courage, takes responsibility for their own actions, has the capacity to withstand pain and discomfort, and has a transpersonal commitment. So in other words, a loyalty to something greater than himself.
What's that a definition of?
Of a healthy warrior archetype. So, I was saying it's difficult to find context to practice or to develop this warrior archetype. Difficult to find people to model it for us. I would say that within the Sangha and within Dharma practice, we have a pretty good context. I certainly have some very good examples. I think of men like Guhya Vajra, like Manju Vajra, both Vajra people, incidentally, Vajrananda. They're all men who are strong men, and tender and loving men. But they've integrated that tenderness within a very strong, robust masculinity. So I think there are examples that we can relate to. And I think as a context, Dharma practice will call forth as much energy, as much of this masculine energy and determination as we can muster. Dharma practice is an arena that we can pour these, if you like, more heroic qualities into. Especially because it's being channeled within an ethical framework. We have the ethical framework to make sure that it doesn't turn destructive, or to make sure that we have we can be reflected back when we're being destructive. I know when I got back off my ordination report, I was a bit of an ordination retreat, sorry, after I got ordained, I was a bit of a loose cannon. I was finding, if you like, my own Vajra qualities. And I did need a little bit of help and guidance to point this out to me. So within the Buddhist context, energy is called virya. In particular, it's called energy in pursuit of the good. So it's energy which is moving in the direction of the three jewels, in the direction of liberation. And before I go on, I just want to say, you know, this is a one-sided talk. All talks are going to be one-sided. This is a one-sided talk. I'm emphasizing this more masculine quality, the more yang, if you like, quality. We need the yin, we need the receptive, we need its counterbalancing quality of patience, of kshanti. But I just wanted to emphasize this one aspect today, these qualities of determination, vigor, decisiveness, application, lack of compromise. So I want to say a few things about virya. And I've taken a lot of this material about virya from a talk by Subhuti, if you're interested in following up. Very good talk. You can download from Free Buddhist Audio. It's in a Mind and Mental Events series, a series of talks he gave to the order. And this is talk 8, if you're interested. And you'll also find it in slightly more condensed form within a book by Bhante Sangrajita called Know Your Mind. So virya, often translated as energy in pursuit of the good. So good presumes this dharmic orientation. It presumes that we have the three jewels, that we're aligned to the three jewels. Subhuti gave an interesting rendering of virya. He says it's what connects faith to effective practice. It's what connects shraddha to effective practice. It's how we potentize our confidence. It's how we bring into effect what we've learned about and what we feel to be true. So it's not just enough to have a strong feeling or a sense that this is the right thing to do. We have to actually actualize it. So virya is directing our energy towards what is skillful, moment by moment, ongoingly. Its opposite is laziness. But within the Buddhist tradition, laziness isn't an inert quality necessarily. It's not just a lack of effort. It is a countervailing effort. It is an effort that is choosing the less skillful. It's when we put our energy into what is less skillful. So that may come across as inert. It may come across as just lying in bed all day. Or it may come across in a very vigorous, energetic way. Gampopa talks about it as making money and subduing enemies. We might find our own equivalents. But where does our energy go into if it doesn't feel as if it's moving towards the three jewels? How skillful is it? So virya is such an important quality that there's loads and loads of different lists, different ways of looking at it. And I'm going to look at a fivefold list. Okay. So, fivefold list of virya. Firstly, it is the energy that arrays itself in armour. So there's a good warrior image for you. The energy that arrays itself in armour. So this isn't all about being sort of stiff and closed and unreceptive and insensitive. Arraying itself in armour, I see as going forth into our day with a sense of diligence, determination, pre-warned about knowing our own habits, knowing our own tendencies, setting ourselves up to work with them. So we have a sense of direction, a sense of confident clarity about what we're doing, how we're wanting to practice, our weak points, our Achilles heels, how are we going to work with that? Especially knowing the challenges of the day, to the extent that we can anticipate the challenges of the day, going forewarned, forearmed, if you like. Looking for, if you like, a heroic determination to be as creative as we can be, especially if we anticipate the day to bring some difficult challenges. So in this sense, it's related to a quality called apamada. Apamada is often translated as vigilance. It's an ethically sensitive aspect of mindfulness. So we're aware of our states of being, we're aware of our state of mind, of what we're saying, of what we're doing, with an ethical sensitivity about it. Sometimes we may need our armour to protect ourselves against other people's reactivity, other people trying to press our buttons. Maybe against other people who are a bit sloppy with their boundaries. So an aspect of this masculine warrior energy is being able to set boundaries, to know when to say no. We don't have to say yes to everything just because we're Buddhists. So that's the first type, the energy that arrays itself in armour. The second type is the energy that is applied effort. So you're probably familiar with effort as a stage, as an aspect of the Eightfold Path, right effort or perfect effort. It's traditionally talked about in terms of eradicating unskillful states of mind, preventing unskillful states of mind, developing the skillful, and maintaining the skillful. So this raises a whole interesting question of what is this quality of effort? How do we apply effort? How do we apply will in the spiritual life? We're probably familiar with balanced effort within meditation. So immediately this is bringing to mind the fact that effort has to be balanced. It has to be balanced with receptivity. If we're just trying to apply the will without any awareness of what's going on, then that's what we call willfulness, over-willfulness. So we do, in order to apply a balanced effort, we need receptivity, we need mindfulness, and we need the effort. So it's intelligent, applied effort is intelligent. It's not just brute force. It understands the nature of spiritual progress, and it understands our own nature. So, for example, in meditation, So there you are, you're, if anything like me, doing your mindfulness of breathing, and mind keeps wandering off. And a little bit of me thinks, I should be able to stop my mind from wandering off. I should have the control over my mind to stop that happening. That's a wrong view. There's a wrong view of myself being in control of my mind. What I can do in any moment of consciousness is to apply my mind to the awareness of the breath. And whenever it wanders off, when I'm unconscious, I'm unconscious. I don't have choice there. But then when I become aware again, I can bring the mind back again. So there's something about understanding the nature of spiritual practice. We bring awareness, we bring volition, and that's all we can do. We can just keep on doing that and keep on doing that. We don't have control over ourselves. There's a false... The belief that we have control over ourselves is a false understanding. Applied effort is applied, and it has to keep on being applied. And I can really see for myself that there's moments in my life when I'm more applied. I say, okay, this week, in my chapter, if you're my chapter members here, this week I'm going to do such and such. And for 1 week, for example, I won't look at the computer in the morning, and I'll make sure I do a 40-minute meditation each day, and I'll do a 3-minute breathing space each day or something. And that really works for me. That really does something, I think. And at the end of the week, that's really great. And maybe the following week I might tweak it up a little bit more. And then it sort of dies away a little bit, and I lose touch with that intentionality. And then I just get a bit more sort of flabby, spiritually flabby. And I think, what's happened here? Need to tighten back up again. Reapply the effort. There's something about when we put in steady, ongoing effort, it has an effect. It raises our state of being. And when that dies back again, then we get a bit more flabby again, spiritually flabby. So the degree of effort we need is very small. So, you know, you can notice right now your bum on the seat. And it doesn't take, well, I can't, but you can. It doesn't take very much effort at all to notice that. But to keep on doing that for the rest of this talk would require a steady, consistent effort. And it's something about little drops of effort, steadily, ongoingly, in a sort of... in a manner that we can keep going. That's the sort of effort that we need. Bhante says, most of us put up with too dull a state of consciousness. With just a little more effort, we can raise our minds up and be in a generally much more positive state of consciousness. It just takes a little bit of effort in an ongoing way to stay in a much, much more positive state of consciousness. Bhante says, almost live in a state of dilute dhyana. And I think one place to look out for here is, what do we do outside of meditation? What sort of states of mind do we dwell in outside of meditation? What does our mind do when it's idling? If it's anything like me, there's thoughts and fantasies that just maintain a habitual state of consciousness. Could be sort of little grungy, complaining thoughts. I notice pretty much every time I do any housework in my flat, I go into these little grungy states of mind thinking, Vajradevi's hasn't hoovered the carpet for a while, and I'm sure I've washed up more often than she has this week. And it's all these little silly little grungy thoughts. Or for you, it might be tempting little appetising thoughts about what you could arrange to get a little pleasure hit. I'm not so familiar with those. I'm more of a hate type myself. But I'm sure you can you can work out your own little background grungy thoughts. If we were working with the hindrances outside of meditation all the time, then when we meditated, according to an order member called Sona, when we meditated, it would just be like throwing the sandbags out of a hot air balloon and just rising up, and just rise up into dhyana. Because what happens when we meditate is we just have a more intensified experience of our everyday consciousness. So if our everyday consciousness is just sort of grungy, anxiety, ill will, whatever it is, that's what we'll experience in meditation. So the third sort of energy. So that was the energy that is applied effort. The third sort, the energy that doesn't despair. I like this one, the energy that doesn't despair. There's many ways that we can despair, I think. A form of self-pity. It's the sort of mind state that says, I'm uniquely disadvantaged in some way. There's something about me that means I can't put this into practice in the same way that other people do. Maybe it's my genes, or maybe it's my upbringing, or maybe it's just my propensities are so deep, I can't make any progress. All this Buddhism stuff's okay for everyone else, or this enlightenment stuff's okay for everyone else. All I can do is fill in the dots. Or maybe it's something like, I'm too good for this situation. People don't appreciate me enough. To me, it feels like a kind of exhaustion, a coming to the end of my creative resources and coming up with some storyline that lets me off the hook. So this is what you need to look out for, storylines that let you off the hook. Subhuti says, it is victim mentality, where you allow yourself an indulgence because you consider yourself to be morally non-responsible because you are the victim. Because you have abnegated moral responsibility, you don't even apply a moral judgment to your abnegation of moral responsibility. So you are in deep trouble. So with this sort of energy, the energy that doesn't despair, we don't believe and entertain these kinds of thoughts, these storylines that let us off the hook. Remember, a healthy aspect of this warrior energy is it's taking responsibility, especially for ourselves. And I think this is one of the toughest aspects of spiritual life, is always taking responsibility for our state of mind, especially when the going gets tough. Continue to recognize that I'm responsible for this state of mind without blame, without self-pity, and without self-hatred. So the fourth kind of energy, the energy that doesn't turn back. The energy that doesn't turn back. So life is hard. Spiritual life is hard, and even the spiritual life, even Buddhist life, isn't all nice. We quickly realise, if we spend much time around the Sangha, that Sangha members also have their faults. Our teachers have their faults. The people we initially respected really, really strongly have their faults. And the more we get involved in the Sangha, the more we can find ourselves in conflict with other people. And it's easy to think, this isn't what I signed up for. I came here to get away from all this rubbish. And look, it's just more of the same. This is a really important point of our spiritual life. We experience it as betrayal. We experience ourselves as betrayed. Other people have betrayed our idealistic expectations of them. And this is the end of naivety. If we don't want to let go of our naivety, then we'll leave. We'll find a way out of this situation and we'll look for some other nirvana in our samsara. Some nirvana that we think will give us everything on our own terms, and we won't find it. So the work of the spiritual life is abandoning the hope of ever finding that, of ever getting everything on our own terms, of expecting everything to work out to our satisfaction. And this is a real danger of our current culture, I think, consumer society. Subhuti calls it a softening society because we're conditioned to expect satisfaction. Everyone is out to give us satisfaction. Market forces are geared to satisfying our every whim because we are willing to pay to be satisfied. We are willing to pay for pleasure. We pay for ease, we pay for comfort, we pay for smiling faces, we pay for efficiency. And we're really unused to difficulty. And I have to say that there's a real danger that the Buddhist Centre plays into this. We have to sort of market ourselves. We have to give people what they want on their own terms. And sometimes it can feel like people want all the teachings and all the presentations to be on their own terms, to suit them in the style and in the content that they want. And I was just thinking of those stories you might have heard from the Zen monasteries, where you have to kneel in the snow for several days outside before you're given a single teaching. I think a sort of closet Japanese Zen Buddhist in me would quite like to do that. So, this is the energy that doesn't turn back. Don't turn back. It's very, very painful to turn back. There's this phrase, better not to start. Once started, better to finish. So again, beware if you hear yourself thinking up these storylines that is rehearsing arguments for stepping back, for leaving, for doing something completely different. How are you justifying these storylines to yourself? Spiritual life is tricky, and it's not uncommon to go through dark nights of the soul. It churns up all sorts of stuff which has to be reconciled and integrated. So finally, the virya that is never satisfied. Surely we should be satisfied. Isn't Buddhism all about being contented? All about peace? I think this is pointing out a danger of the spiritual life. We may come along to the Buddhist Centre because we're in difficulty, we're in pain. And we aspire to a life that doesn't have that pain. It doesn't have that sharp pain of being maladapted to life. And so we find ways of dealing with it. We find good dharmic ways of dealing with it. And that pain goes away. Fantastic. And then the danger is that we settle into a cozy life where our spiritual practice is a sort of caretaker practice. We keep it boiling over, or just sort of ticking over. Come along to the Buddha Center for our weekly dose of, you know, top up or whatever it is. In a way, that's fantastic. But I think spiritual practice is a little bit like running a business. If you're not making the effort to move forward, you're going to be moving backwards. So there's something missing with this danger of settling down, and that is what's called longing shraddha, the longing and the yearning for deeper insight. This longing that doesn't let you settle down, doesn't let you ever feel satisfied. And I realise that people have their responsibilities, people have, you know, time constraints and so on. But I think if you have this longing shraddha, this longing energy, this energy that won't settle down, then you'll always be on the lookout for opportunities. You'll be setting up strategically so that your life gives you more and more opportunity for practice. Maybe it's quite a long-term strategy, but you'll always be on the lookout for opportunities to get away on retreat, to come along more often, to go off in solitary, whatever it is. So finally, I just want to say a few things about Vajrapani. So I mentioned that the warrior archetype is, if you like, the psychological archetype of energy, the everyday psychological level. And that has shadow sides that we've heard about. But there's a transcendental archetype of energy called Vajrapani. He first comes along in the Pali Canon. He's a bit of a sort of henchman of the Buddha. He's a bit of a heavy. And he, through time, he develops into a bodhisattva, who's the protector of the Vajra family. And this is a wrathful image of him. Blue, fat. He's often trampling on bodies, although not in this one. And he's so incandescent with energy that it's as if he's set fire to the air around him. So the Vajra is this symbol. Imagine being a sort of primitive person who didn't understand weather systems, and you hear thunder. Imagine the experience of witnessing a thunderstorm. Imagine how awe-inspiring, well, even when we know what it means, it's still pretty awe-inspiring to hear really loud thunderclap. Vajrapani, the Vajra. Well, Vajrapani means Vajra in hand. The Vajra, in a way, stands for that experience of awe, of vast energy, unstoppable energy. And I just want to finish with a quote from Vasantra, from his book on Meeting the Buddhas, talking about Vajrapani. As the bodhisattva of energy or power, Vajrapani is obviously intimately connected with the Vajrayana, because the Vajrayana sees everything in terms of energy. The Vajra itself, the diamond thunderbolt, is unstoppable and unbreakable. This is perhaps because it is made of pure energy. The path of Vajrapani, then, is very much concerned with seeing the entire universe as consisting of energy, and rallying that energy to the cause of spiritual development. Through the practice of his visualization, sadhana, your mind becomes like pure Vajra, like a diamond which cuts without being cut. You learn to seize the spiritual initiative and affect the world positively without allowing it to have any negative effect on you. Vajrapani is a heroic figure. His path is one of overcoming fear. To walk it, we have to confront everything that terrifies us. Often what is most really frightening for us as human beings is our unowned power, the energy we could possess. A few years ago, en route to lead a retreat in Italy, I stopped off in Chamonix at the foot of the Alps. A few hours later, a friend and I were in a cable car, hanging by a thread above the valley thousands of feet below. Off to our left was the massive bulk of Mont Blanc. Gazing across at it, I realised I found it very beautiful, but also terrible, awe-inspiring and frightening. Exploring my feelings further, I saw it was not the peaceful rock of the mountain that was affecting me. Faced with this external vastness, an intuition was being sparked off within me. I understood that, enthralled by the mountain, it was the sheer volume of my own potential energy that I was experiencing. Suddenly I knew what it was that I'd been trying to exclude from my awareness. It was a vision of sheer freedom, of becoming someone prepared to plunge into the vast abyss of liberation. The prospect of walking the path of Vajrapani, confronting our own energy, power and freedom, can be terrifying. To experience the sheer exultant bliss of success on this path would be awesome. We should lose our heads, our safe, conventional judgments. We should lose our average, comfortable selves. We should break cover and emerge from our quiet anonymity in the group. We should no longer masquerade as innocent bystanders in life. We should be the main actors. We should begin to expand, to swell with tremendous energies. Where would it end? I think so.